Thank you so much for joining us this morning. It's a great pleasure to see you. My name is Kathleen Newland, and I'm from the Migration Policy Institute in Washington, where I direct our programs on migration and development, as well as our program on refugee protection. But I'm here today with my migration and development hat on, obviously, and it's really very gratifying to be able to introduce you to the handbook on diaspora engagement, Developing a Roadmap for Engaging Diasporas in Development. This is a project that we've been working on with IOM for the better part of 2 years, and in fact even longer than that, because the handbook draws on research that both Dovlin Agunias and I did at the Migration Policy Institute going back to sort of 2009-2010. And the handbook is trying to accomplish many things. One is to create a sort of bridge between research and policy development, research and practice, and that we've really tried to translate our research findings into a form that's useful for policymakers who are looking to develop more productive relationships with the diaspora. And it's we really worked hard, MPI and IOM, coming from our sort of respective positions as a think tank and as an operational organization, to make that bridge and to create something that would be very user-friendly and accessible to policymakers and practitioners, and helpful also to members of the diaspora. Although it is a handbook that is sort of directed toward people in government, we've been very encouraged by feedback from diaspora organizations that they are also finding it useful. So we're looking forward to your feedback, because although we have this printed, physical, durable copy of the handbook, we think of it as a living document. It also resides online on the MPI website, on the IOM website, and on the website of the Global Forum for Migration and Development. So we will update it. We have the possibility of adding new content all the time. And so we really look forward to getting examples of practice, example of new institutions developing, and of course refinements to the roadmap, which forms the strategic framework for the work as a whole. So I promise to be brief. I'm going to stick to that for once, and hand over to our partner Frank Lasko, the head of research and publications at IOM. Frank.
Okay, thank you very much, Kathleen, and good morning to everyone. Perhaps I can say a few words about the history of this project, because it's important, I think, to recognize that this is very much linked to the GFMD, the Global Forum on Migration and Development. This handbook actually responds to one of the key recommendations that was made at the GFMD in Athens, calling for this kind of handbook to be prepared. And it was then developed within the framework of something which is called the Platform for Partnership Initiative within the GFMD, and it was and it has been funded by the governments of the Netherlands and Switzerland. So I think it's important to recognize that this project has been born out of the GFMD. And also importantly to recognize that we were able to complete the survey work and to produce many of these findings because we were able to tap into the GFMD network of focal points which exists. One of the first things that was done in preparing this handbook was to conduct a survey of the GFMD focal points to identify which institutions in government are responsible for diaspora engagement policies and programs. And I think around 60 countries responded, and more than 400 different institutions and entities were identified. So I think this is an interesting outcome or example of what the GFMD itself can achieve. And no doubt one of the speakers more closely linked to the GFMD than I can say more about this. Secondly, I think I'd like to acknowledge the fact that this project is very much a collaborative effort. Dovlin Agunias holds a joint position in Bangkok, based at the IOM office there, which is jointly funded by the Migration Policy Institute and IOM. She's the regional research officer there. And it's, as Kathleen said, it's an example of the collaboration that we seek to develop further in the future based on our respective strengths. Finally, Dovlin is currently on a world tour. She was recently in Jerusalem and Mauritius. There will be further launches in Washington and Bangkok and possibly other places in the future. The handbook is going to be translated into French, Spanish, and Arabic, and possibly other languages.
Icelandic. No.
You'll be doing that one. But more importantly, and I hope we will get to discuss this at the end of this session, the key question is, how is this going to be used? Because we were here about a year ago talking about this project, and one of the key questions that was put to us from the Commission side was, it's great to produce these documents, and we've tried to make it as user-friendly as possible, but then how do you ensure that policymakers, decision-makers, project managers actually use the handbook? Thank you very much.
Thanks, Frank. So I now want to turn the mic over to Dovlin for a presentation of some of the sort of key findings and features of the handbook. As Frank has mentioned, Dovlin currently has a joint appointment with as a policy analyst at MPI and a regional research officer of IOM based in Bangkok. She knows her subject extremely well, not only as a scholar and practitioner within IOM, but as a migrant. She's one of those privilege holders of sort of triple passports, and I defy anyone here to come up with a more exotic combination than US, Philippines, and Iceland. Dovlin is a citizen of all three countries.
I got everything.
And if, when you have time to talk to her about that story, it will be well worth your while. So we miss her in Washington, and it's great to meet each other in all these various locations around the world. It's been a real joy collaborating on this work. So, Dovlin, over to you.
Well, thank you, Kathleen, for the kind introduction. And yes, for the reminder that you miss me in Washington. Thank you. I like that a lot. And thank you to all of you for coming here today. As Frank has mentioned, before I came here to Brussels, I'm sort of like a world tour on this handbook. Early last week, I was in Jerusalem, where I attended a conference on diaspora engagement hosted by the Israeli government. And then immediately after that, I flew to Mauritius to attend a Global Forum on Immigration and Development high-level forum, this time focusing on African engagement of their diasporas. And then from there, I came directly to here, where I had a chance to speak to some of you who are here and to discuss diaspora engagement from a European perspective and experience. And what's really interesting, you know, in the conversations I had over the last 10 days in three different continents, I sense that there's this recognition already among many, many different actors about the importance of the diaspora as actors for development. But what's interesting for me is that there's also this sense of urgency. That despite the knowledge that, yes, diasporas are important, there's this sense of urgency that we are not doing everything we need to be doing, that we may not be doing the right thing, and that there's so much still that we don't know. And this sense of urgency you feel, not just by talking to countries of origin that are just starting to engage their diaspora, so countries like Mauritius and many countries in Africa, but you even feel this sense of urgency when talking to countries that have historically long, meaningful relationships with their diaspora, such as the Jewish diaspora or the Armenian diaspora. And I think it is in this context that the handbook hopefully would be useful to many all of us here, because despite all the talk about diaspora engagement, there's still a huge gap in knowledge and substance. And what we hope is that this handbook would be able to fill some of that gaps and assists us in sharing knowledge and, more importantly, using that knowledge. There are three things that I think makes this handbook a unique resource or tool for policymakers and practitioners. And let me run through them and then I'll end so we have more time for discussion. First, much of the information provided in this handbook came directly from those who actually do diaspora engagement and not just those who think about diaspora engagement. As Kathleen has mentioned, the handbook builds on previous work that IOM and MPA has done in diaspora engagement, and that work was already a product of direct engagement with people on the ground. But the handbook, as Frank mentioned, it also was prepared under the framework of the Global Forum on Migration and Development through the Platform for Partnership, or the PFP, which is a GFMD-sponsored tool. Through the PFP, we've asked GFMD participant states to share with us their experiences, their concerns, their needs, their priorities. And we administered this two-part survey, asking them about their diaspora engagement policies and programs. And we were able to get tremendously good response. 62 national governments answered that survey. And then we conducted in-depth interviews with 35 different governmental institutions to really hone in on what are the challenges that you face on the ground while implementing many of these programs. What works? What does not? Why do you think that is the case? And the handbook tries to outline that in this publication. We've conducted the interviews in English, in French, in Spanish. And we've also done consultations. As Frank mentioned, one was done here in Brussels with the UN Joint Migration and Development Initiative, who at that time last year was also doing their handbook, focusing more on the civil society experience. And the handbook has been discussed through the GFMD, first in Puerto Vallarta 2 years ago. We presented the draft of the handbook in Geneva last December, where governments have the chance to vet the findings and discuss it with us directly. So this is a product of a long process, which I think also reflects what diaspora engagement is about. It's also about process. One other interesting aspect of this handbook is that it is not exhaustive, but it's very selective. That is why the handbook is this thick and not this thick. Mm-hmm. And I think that as someone who co-wrote this, it would be easier for me to actually write a handbook that this thick. But we don't want to do that. We wanted to present a carefully selected menu of viable options and program options based on actual experiences from around the world. We wanted to identify what is the latest thinking on key areas concerning diaspora engagement. For instance, what is the latest thinking on remittances? How about on tapping direct investments? How about on transferring human capital expertise and skills? Those are three topics that have one chapter devoted in the handbook. But we also covered other emerging areas that we think are important, but governments are not really thinking about them as much as, let's say, remittances. So, for instance, we have a chapter on diaspora philanthropy, diaspora tourism, and a market, capital market investments. Discussions on diaspora bonds is just starting, but we will also cover that in the handbook. There's also a section on the handbook that talk about the institutional and the legal framework. As Frank mentioned, we had a review of this diaspora institutions that you find almost everywhere in the world right now. And we've had 77 in total when we did the review last year, different offices, bodies, and posts at various levels of governments. And these are institutions that were created to specifically formalize the relationship with the diaspora. And we have a section of that as well. And a chapter on some of the legislations as well as regulations that governments have adopted to encourage diaspora engagement, from overseas voting rights to tax breaks on bringing your properties back home should you decide to stay or return to your country of origin. A third feature of the handbook, which I think is really important, is what the title implies. I mean, this is developing a roadmap. And so we just didn't discuss the actual policies and programs. We went beyond that. And we wanted the governments to offer sort of the importance of having a strategic action plan if you are really interested in engaging your diasporas fully. Sometimes when we think of diaspora engagement, we think of the outcomes. You know, we think of how much in diaspora bonds can we bring, how much investments can we bring to the country of origin, how many people can return to the country of origin and share their time and expertise. But in our interactions with governments and policymakers and diaspora members themselves, we found that diaspora engagement is also as much as a process as an outcome. How policies and programs and institutions are chosen and created are important. How the goals are achieved are important. These are critical indicators of success. And we have three chapters in this handbook that focuses on a roadmap that outlines what are the critical elements that governments need to think across the board. That we think four critical elements that they have to think about regardless of where they are or what are their priorities. And page 24 of the handbook details this four key elements. And let me just mention it. We think it's really important for governments to identify goals and priorities. It's important to know the diaspora. And it's important to build trust and to mobilize stakeholders. It is also important to have a renewed focus on building capacities. Sometimes you see all these institutions and realize that, yes, there's a huge mandate, but there's no capacity to fulfill that mandate. So it's important to build capacity and monitor progress and measure impact, because much of what we know is based on actually very little evidence. And we tried very hard to look into a number of the few evaluations out there. But certainly there's room for more monitoring and evaluation. In short, the handbook is a source of information. It is a practical guide to governments. As Frank mentioned, we wanted to maximize this handbook's use. It will be translated into French, Spanish, and Arabic. There's a companion website hosted by the GFMD where you can download the handbook in full or by chapters. Looking forward, you know, knowledge that we have put in here is here, and it reflects what was at the time when we were doing the research. But knowledge is not constant. It's not. It accumulates. It changes. And we hope that the handbook will be updated periodically to reflect the change in our thinking on diaspora engagement. But in the meantime, we would appreciate feedback. And that's why we're here. And as co-author of the handbook, I can go on and on and on about the merits of this handbook and how wonderful it is and how it could be potentially useful to the work that you do. But I think the ultimate judges of the usefulness of this handbook are the readers, and that's you. And so please provide us feedback. So as we move on and try to accumulate much of this knowledge, we'll come up with an even better handbook next time around. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Devlin. We really hope that every one of your copies will look like this. You know? That's what we want to see.
I just did that, by the way. Yeah. Make it look like it.
Lots of tabs, lots of sort of dog ears, and so on and so forth. Well, to begin that process of feedback, we are really grateful to three people who've agreed to come and. Talk a little bit about the handbook or related issues. And we are going to begin with Eva Ackerman-Borre, the Swedish Ambassador for the Global Forum on Migration and Development, who I think has probably been familiar with this handbook process since at least 2009, when we started developing this this roadmap that appears on page 24 and is now preparing to take over the chair of the GFMD as we go into the high-level dialogue, and is one of the critical thinkers about this whole set of issues. So Eva, thank you so much for agreeing to join us today.
Thank you very much, Kathleen, and thank you to the MPI and IOM for inviting me to take part in this interesting discussion. It's really a very topical issue and important not only to the Swedish incoming chair of the Global Forum, but it has been on the agenda for the Global Forum since its inception. I would like to start by saying that although I'm not as interesting as Dublin, I'm also actually part of the diaspora, and part of a diaspora organization that works for development of my home country. But this is said a little bit jokingly, but I'm from the island of Gotland in the middle of the Baltic, and those who move from there to the mainland, it's a very long move. And I'm now based in Stockholm, part of the Gotlanders in the diaspora in Stockholm, about 2,500 people gather up in a network, and we work for development of our Heimat, if you like. So I'm, I can look at this issue also from that perspective. And that is maybe one of the starting points that I would like to make, is that diasporas are, of course, a very difficult group to define, and policy solutions and suggestions, measures and actions can look extremely different, I would say, and also the mandate, if you like, or the purpose of diaspora organizations, or just diaspora in general, can look so very different. And I think that that's important to remember. They can have small goals, and they can have really large political goals. I mean, everything in between, I think that is really important. I have been asked to talk a little bit about the Global Forum, or maybe also bigger picture of international discussions on the links between migration and development, and how the role of the diaspora as a development agent can be, has been taken into that discussion, but also for the future. And as has been said already by the previous speakers, the Global Forum has had the theme of diasporas on the agenda for the entire time, even also on topics that is not at first glance labeled diaspora, but more practical ideas about migration policy development, legislative development also has implications for the diaspora and for the mobility, for instance, of diaspora back and forth. I'll come back a little bit later to that. So diasporas can be a component of this discussion thematically, theoretically, policy-wise, but it can also be, I would say, a part of this discussion by being present. And I think those are two different topics that we can look a little bit on in this discussion. In the Global Forum and also in the upcoming high-level dialogue on migration and development, the role of diaspora will be present as a topic for sure. The Swedish, it's now a very big part of the Mauritius chair of the Global Forum, but also the Swedish chair is looking into the possibility of enhancing the development component of the discussion in the Global Forum on Migration and Development. It has been more balanced, I would say, towards core migration issues, but we would like to try to, if possible, get it a little bit, get the balance more equal between the two different topics. And here, of course, the role of the diaspora and diaspora organizations in development-related work is really, of course, a main priority. So we will work towards that end. Since the beginning of this discussion, and of course it didn't begin with the Global Forum, the discussion was there before, but I think the focus on diasporas came with this linking very clearly migration and development policy, and it has developed over the years. And that, of course, comes from the Global Forum, as I'm sure you're aware, is not an entity in itself with an independent mandate given from somebody, but it's actually a process that is led by states and with the very active involvement of international organizations and other actors to set the agenda themselves. And I think that the role of the diaspora on the agenda of this forum has come with a realization by states that diasporas it's an important component in their own policy making. That I would say, and I would then be happy to take my own country, Sweden, as an example. Sweden is a latecomer in this discussion with the diasporas. We have, and I think many other countries that have been traditionally, and I don't like to use it, the term receiving country, but I, for the sake of simplification here, Sweden has viewed itself as a country of destination, reception of migrants, asylum seekers, and we've worked with a goal of integration that people come permanently and are given status to remain. And so we've never thought of this link to the country of origin, and it's really just the last 5, 6, 7 years that this has become an issue, and we have been extremely badly placed to work at all with this, that we don't have the organizational structures, we don't have the outreach and so on. So it's just only the few last, say, 3 years since the government appointed a parliamentary commission in 2009 to look at the issues of circular migration and the links with developments, that this issue has come really up on the table. And this parliamentary commission now has produced some results, and I just wanted to give a couple of examples that are could be important for the continued policy discussion on this issue. And one of the issues is, of course, the issue of what can migration policy do for this this area. And in the way that we've analyzed the problem, we think that mobility is a really crucial issue. So that has implications for how you devise your migration policy. You have to look at the barriers, at the obstacles, and also to the possible facilitators of mobility in order to enhance the role that the diaspora can play, which means that people are supposed to be able to move between the countries. You move to Sweden, you stay in Sweden, you get integrated, and you do what you have to do in Sweden, but you can always go back and you can retain your status in Sweden and move back and forth. And also, of course, the dual citizenship and all of these issues is part of this package that we are looking into in order to strengthen the role of diaspora in the development of their own country of origin. And then that is not totally new for the Swedish government to work with that. But what is totally new, and for what we do not have structures, is to work more actively with the diaspora. And here we've had a great hesitation from the part of our development institutions, both the policy-making part in the government, but also with our development agency, CEDA, to actually work with diaspora. It has been a contentious issue, but that has been overcome, I would say, and now we have a few examples already, but We are working with the idea of establishing a resource center for diaspora organizations in Sweden that can support the development-related work in the countries of both in Sweden, which is difficult to do with development money, as I'm sure all of you know, but also, of course, in the country of origin, which is a little bit more easy. And the Swedish government is then using development cooperation funds to contribute to the development-related projects that are initiated by this diaspora group. And this activity is being built up, but we do have a sort of pilot project with the Somali diaspora that we are I shouldn't say proud of, but at least happily surprised that we are finally getting to do something like that. So the issue of structure, and this is also very well formulated in the organization structure, all of this, I think, in many countries is a challenge for governments to work around. We are not, when new issues come about, when new findings are in place, the structures are always lagging behind, the organization, the budgets, and this is, of course, a really important point. Everybody thinks that this is an important issue, the analysis is made, but how do we actually make it happen in practice? And this is mainly, you know, a strong focus, I would say, not in the international discussions on this. I mean, we can exchange views on this, but the practical work needs to be done on the national level, and it's can be supported, it should be supported by the discussion that is taking place in the Global Forum, but also in other international fora, I would say. And just to finish, I would just say that, I mean, as the incoming chair of the Global Forum, and also for the United Nations High-Level Dialogue on Migration and Development in September 2018, I think that Sweden and also many other countries that are interested in this are very much set to put a larger emphasis on the development aspects, and this is one of the most, of course, important issues. And finishing, I would like to also thank IOM and MPI for this handbook, because I said it already over coffee, but this is has already in a very floppy big paper copy that we printed. I'm happy now to have this lovely book. Been circulated by between colleagues in our offices, but also to the Swedish Migration Board and to our development agency CEDA, to start the discussion more practically about how we do this. And I think that this is going to be extremely helpful for discussions on all levels. I mean, I'm sure that we can build a lot of interesting discussions around this in the Global Forum setting, but I think that the real impact it will have on the national level for us to, as a pedagogic tool, actually, you know, the textbook for us to work with. So
the hand textbook, the text handbook.
Yes.
Thank you so much for those comments, Eva. It's really encouraging to hear that it's already started to be used and that it's seen as useful. That is really a critical part of our hopes for this work. And I think Eva's remarks emphasized what an important time this is. I mean, I feel like this is a real window of opportunity for this topic. As Eva said, we've gotten to the point where almost everybody recognizes that diasporas are an important resource, an important sort of node for policy implementation and so on. There's started to be some serious investment in diaspora programs and so on. It's so important right now that this works, because if we get to a point 2 years from now and a lot of money and a lot of effort has been spent and we don't have much to show for it, it could be a real setback for this issue. So I just want to emphasize the importance, as Eva did, of this moment when there's a lot of focus on this topic. And with that, gives me great pleasure to turn over to Rodrigo Ballester, Policy Officer in International Affairs at DG Home here in Brussels. Thank you so much for joining us, Rodrigo.
Good morning, everyone. Also, first of all, yes, to thank the organizers for the invitation. It's a pleasure for the Commission to be here and to be able to share its preliminary thoughts on this paper, on this handbook. And so as Kathleen said, I'm working in the European Commission DG Home Affairs. I'm in charge of in the international unit. So basically, I'm in charge of Morocco and sub-Saharan Africa. So of course, all these diaspora-related matters are very, very much really in the core of our business in DG Home, and especially I think with the countries I'm dealing with. Morocco, for example, is a great example of that. But let me start, please, just by first congratulating the authors. This is an impressive piece of work, I must say. So first of all, let me praise the methodology. You already spoke about it, really bottom-up approach. 62 countries replied to the survey. And this can really, really be felt in the way this handbook is drafted. So you wanted to make it user-friendly. You managed. I'm very happy that it's not, let's say, three times as thick, because it's, I think it's very rich already. But it's true that it's really easy to read, let's say, and contains lots of information. It's targeting practitioners, policymakers in home countries, in host countries, so very complete. It's not that I read it all completely right now, but I must say that, you know, this looks like a kind of diaspora classic, you know, the kind of book that is going to be in this privileged position in your on your shelf, and that you can consult, and of course with a bit of update. But I must say that the recipes are here, and now it's time now to make it happen, as I have said, because it's true. The key role of diaspora is beyond question. I mean, nobody's questioning that. And as you say, actually, in the handbook, it's not a matter of if, but rather a matter of how. How are we going to make it happen? Many, many discussions have been already going on. We are not the first one to discuss the role of diaspora. But I really think that this book could definitely be a breakthrough because of this user-friendliness. It's a very concrete approach. This is not an academic piece of work to me. This is rather real, like for practitioners, for people who are on the ground at different levels, regional, local, even European level, if I may say. And so that's why I found it extremely interesting, and I wanted really to congratulate you on that. Diasporas are the crossroad of different policies. Diaspora is about remittances. This is the obviously. But it's also about circular migration, for example. This really also drew my attention in the handbook. It's about empowering migrants, which is also one of the priorities of the global approach to migration that I'm going to explain in a couple of minutes very briefly. It's also about integration. It's also about tourism, which I must say I didn't know before I saw the handbook. It's also about the negative consequences of the diaspora, you know, the dependency, for example, to some labor markets, separation of families, many, many other things. And you cover them all, so it's, again, extremely, extremely useful. And so, really, congratulations for that. Let me maybe speak from a more European and, let's say, regional point of view. I'm going to first explain quickly the main lines of our global approach to migration and mobility, and then maybe to pick up a couple of initiatives that are now currently being implemented at the European level, and especially in the legal field, and also a bit more in the field of DG Home Affairs, if I may. And so the global approach to migration and mobility. To keep it short and in a couple of words, and since we're in a petit comité, I would be tempted to call it like our official mantra, you know, when it comes to the external dimension of migration in the European Union. And the name global is actually, the adjective global is very, very telling. This is a policy that was first created in 2005, and which aimed really, really at tackling migration from a policy point of view in the European Union in a global way. Global way means that it's not only a matter of security and border control, it is also a matter of security and border control, but it's also a matter of circular migration, let's say legal migration to keep it broad, and also of maximizing migration in development. These were the original three pillars. In November last year, in November 2011, the Commission issued a new communication on global approach to migration and mobility, so which is one of the key features, which is an update of the this 2005 policy, and to which we also added another pillar, which is very, very important to us and to many member states, which is international protection and asylum, the promotion of international protection and asylum. So as you see, our aim is to cover, you know, through these four pillars, migration, mobility as a whole. It's really in a comprehensive way. And also, to, for example, with some key features also in this global approach to migration and mobility, mostly empowering migrants and really making of this policy a migrant-centered one. This communication has been published in 2011. The Council adopted some conclusions some days ago, so very, very recently. And we were, by the way, very grateful for the support we received from the Council on this global approach to migration and mobility. Within this general framework, within these four pillars, where does diaspora stand? Mostly in the fourth one, on migration and development, obviously. This is one, let's say, of the old pillars. It was already there in 2005. Of course, the European Commission was already working on diaspora through DG development for already many, many years. But now, it's true that we find it mostly find it there. And also, I would say, in the first pillar, as we said before, diaspora is also about legal migration, about circular migration, for example, about giving, allowing more mobility for those members of the diaspora who are still want to stay in the host country, in the country of destination, but while, you know, maximizing their impact on their country of origin. This is also a matter of mobility. This is also a matter of legal migration, obviously. So this is where we can find diaspora in our global approach to migration and mobility. Before going into details, just a little forward. Of course, and this is actually said in the title of the handbook. Oh no, actually you said it. It's mostly it targets mostly governments. And of course, diaspora is a policy, such as a general policy, which is very, very much implemented at the local, regional level, and let's say national. We are here at another level, much higher, broader level, much also, we cannot say that in terms of diaspora, we really have our nose on the ground from the European Commission. And so, of course, what is our role there? First, and this applies actually to the general migration policies we are undertaking. We do it, it's a mixed competence. It's a shared competence with member states. Huh? So, and for example, there's also a specific aspect that is still a competence of member states, exclusive one, quotas, for example. You know, like to decide how many migrants are going to arrive, are going to work in X or Y, a member state, in member state A, B, or C. This is still for them to decide. Of course, since already several years, actually decades, I must say, the European Union is assuming more and more competencies in the field of migration. And again, this is not only a matter of border control, this is not only a matter of security, but it's the this migration in the broad sense of the word, as I defined it before in the global approach to migration. But again, we have to keep in mind that our role is different. It's different. We are also here sometimes to deal directly with things because we have concrete initiatives on diaspora, but also here to foment, to encourage, and to make sure as well that, for example, all these incredibly interesting recommendations that are here embedded in this handbook can also be conveyed, you know, imported and fomented. So this has we all have to keep it in mind. If I had to choose and to pick up some topics, let me choose maybe legal migration. Legal migration first, and if I have a bit more time, maybe we can move into integration. As I said, diaspora is key as well in the field of legal migration. Why? Because one of the key roles of diaspora is basically to import their knowledge, their money as well, but since we were talking about human capital, and without having problem and experiencing problem with their working permits, without losing rights, without being able already to be still to create a bridge between the country of origin and the country of destination without losing any rights. And this is, of course, a reciprocal process. It's about the EU and its member states, like maybe being more flexible when giving and when doing their stay regulations and their migration legislation. It's also about the countries of origin also giving these specific rights to members of their diaspora who probably they don't have a passport, they don't have nationality anymore. So it's also creating bridges really, really both ways in order really to ensure this truly circular migration which really goes both ways. What do we do at the level of the EU? Several things. We already have like a legal arsenal when it comes to legal migration. We have the long-term resident directive. We have the EU blue card for highly qualified people. We also have a proposal for seasonal workers. So of course this one applies less. But for example, what about the long-term residence directive? This one allows for periods of absence from the EU without forfeiting long-term residence rights. These long-term residents can leave the country for a period of less than 12 months consecutive. This goes, for example, completely in this direction. Let me give you another example, and this is one I'm very familiar with. We're currently negotiating with some countries of Northern Africa as a response to the Arab Spring, what we call mobility partnerships, concretely with Morocco and with Tunisia. We launched a dialogue with them. The dialogue has been officially launched. And now we are in the step where we are about to start the negotiations of this political declaration that is going to lead to a mobility partnership. Just a little reminder or petite parenthèse, what is a mobility partnership is a specific tool that is very much portrayed in the GAM that we reused already with our eastern neighbors, Moldova, mostly Georgia. We just signed one with Armenia now, and this is a tool which basically is between the EU and the member states who joined in voluntarily, so not all the member states, and the third country. It's a very flexible tool. It creates actually a political framework in the field of which many different initiatives could be undertaken. For example, with Moldova now, currently about 55 or above 60 initiatives are now currently being undertaken, many of them dealing with diaspora. As you may know, I mean, the Moldovan diaspora in the European Union is very, very important. So what we already proposed and exported to the East now, and this is one of the key responses of the European Union to the Arab Spring, has been exported now to the South. And we are starting now with Morocco and with Tunisia. Discussions are ongoing. We'll see about the results. We'll see. But what is definitely sure is that when we speak to these countries, the diaspora is really at the heart of their concerns, especially Morocco, which is the example I know the best. Moroccan diaspora here in Europe is more than important, no? It's probably one of the, I mean, in Belgium, in the Netherlands, in France, in Italy, in Spain, is normally ranks among the first or the second. Moroccan authorities already did a great job with it. I mean, I'm sure they will learn a lot from the handbook, but maybe less than other member states, or maybe less than other countries in the region. They have lots of experience in this field. They have ministries. They have one ministry, but they call them. They have this concept that they call mobilité des compétences, which, according to them, goes actually beyond the brain drain, and it's a very, very innovative way to tackle this diaspora relations. Needless to say that this is going to be at the heart of the mobility partnership. We already spoke about it with them, and that touches among, you know, different issues. When we speak about diaspora with Moroccans, we speak about integration, for example. We speak about, of course, brain drain. It's a concern. It's a concern. I mean, these societies are getting more and more developed and are worried about, of course, this potential diaspora, these young qualified people that may never come back. They're already worried about the ones that left, and they are now like inventing these very, very innovative schemes to make sure that they're going to benefit from Canada or from Spain or from France of their knowledge and their experience. But so it's very much it's really in the core of the mobility partnership. How are we going to implement that? Two basic ways. We have already some legislation, as I said. and also through some pilot countries, pilot projects. Of course, again, I repeat, this is more for member states to really implement specific bilateral agreements within this partnership, between this mobility partnership. We'll see. We'll see. The situation now in Europe is not so, let's say, it's not the best, not ideal in terms of, in order to set up now all these circular migration programs. But still, it's in the agenda. And of course, through this arsenal of directives and legal European legal legislation, European legislation, that is really also meant to serve this purpose. Remittances, obviously. So that's more for our colleagues inside of the Commission, our colleagues of DG Development and Cooperation, who are dealing very actively on that. A report is ongoing. Of course, diaspora's remittances are also at the core of all the dialogues we are having now, with not only with the bilateral ones, but also think about the ACP-EU dialogue on the basis of the Cotonou Convention. Think about the Rabat process. So all these issues are very, very much on the table. But again, don't forget our role of impulsion. You know, impulsion here. What can the European Union from Brussels really do exactly and concretely with the diasporas? Not much, but still some things. No? For example, to create an EU platform. It's important. One of the problems we have with diasporas, the European Union, I mean, is first, who are we going to talk to? Sometimes, as you know, you all know, diasporas can be heterogeneous. Several players, several associations. Who do we speak to? First thing. And by the way, I know that Santo Deng is already doing an absolutely tremendous work on that, and we already had the occasion to collaborate concretely. But this is ongoing, and this is something that we are really strongly encouraging. As well, the capacity building of the diaspora association. It's not a secret to anyone that dealing with EU projects is rather cumbersome, mm-hmm. and it takes normally a lot of capacity, administrative capacity. I mean, it's very bureaucratic, and normally it's a huge amounts of money, and so this needs already as well some administrative capacity. So this is also another concrete problem that we face, and in order to speak ourselves directly to diaspora organizations. But anyway, I know that I'm going probably to find already many, many answers in this handbook. If you're waiting, if you want our feedback, I'm afraid you have to wait a bit more, because this is a bit too rich to be digested right now. But I can assure you that this book is going to circulate within our DG and within the European Commission. And again, congratulations. I'm very much convinced that if this is really, really, let's say, promoted properly, it could really become one of the classic, one of the breakthrough elements in really making this happen. So thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Rodrigo, for those really, really encouraging words. Rodrigo said that he hadn't yet sort of read through the handbook. And one of the things we really tried to assure is that you don't have to, you know, that it's not a book to sort of pick up and read cover to cover, not that we object to your doing that, but we really designed it in a way that you can sort of dive into it, look for a topic that you're interested in, and find, even if you only have 5 minutes, if you look at, you know, a page like page 96, which, you know, has a box that summarizes the main points of the chapter, the main takeaways, and so on. So it's flexible. You know, if you have 5 minutes or if you have 2 days, you know, there's a way to engage with the handbook, we hope. Finally, and most importantly, we come to Santo Deng, who is the president of the board of the Diaspora Forum for Development. And as Rodrigo mentioned, very much involved with the EU-Africa Diaspora Platform. The Diaspora Forum for Development is one of the four sort of key organizations around which this platform is built. And we're just really delighted and grateful, Santo, that you're able to join us today and give us some sort of initial thoughts about diaspora engagement at the ground level, building up.
Thank you, Kathleen. Good morning, everybody. As Kathleen said, my name is Santu Deng, but you'll be wondering where I come from actually originally. I'm actually South Sudanese since last year. So I used to call myself a Sudanese, but always saying that I'm from South Sudan within Sudan itself. So it's the newest nation actually that joined the UN and the African Union and also the Community of Nations. So I'm proud of that nowadays, and I've been always proud about it. So,
congratulations.
So thank you for inviting me this morning, and thank you for IAM and also for the for Migration Policy Institute. I thought they were only based in Washington, and this morning I was surprised when I got the email to participate MPI Europe. I was like, wow, these guys are expanding to Europe too. So it's wonderful that we have an institute that is next to our doors, actually. And as a practitioner, as a diaspora myself, and a member of a platform that is based in the Netherlands, actually, the Diaspora Forum for Development, I'll just give you a very brief introduction what the platform is, and then so that you understand where we come from and where are we going to. And then afterwards, I will give my a bit of inputs about the document that has been provided. It's a very good manual, very good manual indeed. I remember in 2009 when we met with Kathleen at the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, and this was the first thing that actually we went through it, a roadmap.
Right.
And it's wonderful to see such an end product in the end, because I forwarded the link actually to some of the board members, and nobody actually expected that this would be the end product.
Your input was very important.
So thank you very much, actually, for having such a manual that is not scientific, as you said, but it's going to be something that you just digest. If you need something, you can use it very easily. You don't have to go through everything, but you can find something that is actually suitable for yourself. And as a migrant in this case, I think, and as a diaspora, I think we are very grateful for that. And this is a unique product that came out of all these GFMDs, actually, that took place. So it's wonderful. Diaspora Forum for Development is a migrant-led platform that was established actually in 2007 by some of the key diaspora leaders in the Netherlands. And as all of you know, Holland actually, or the Netherlands, has been a very key actor for the last few years in migration development. So most of you would just wonder why are they so involved actually with migration and development, and why are they so engaged with diaspora. It did not come out of the blue. It's actually the perseverance of diaspora groups, the well organization of these communities. We come, as Balestra was saying, or Rodrigo was saying earlier on, we are a very diverse group. You can't even imagine how many diaspora organizations that are based in the Netherlands. And that's been a discussion actually with the policymakers from the beginning and development agencies. Within one country, for example, you will have at least 40 organizations. One country, 40 organizations. And they are all doing the same. Or maybe sometimes slightly different than each other. So it makes it very difficult if you are a funder, or if you are a knowledge institute, or if you are a policymaker, to dialogue actually with whom. Because the other one will say, hey, I'm actually the one who is representing the community. The other one will say, no, I'm the one who is representing the community. So you do have a dilemma. And so in the end, gradually, the focus became that we should set a platform for ourselves as countries. And that's how it started. And we did that as Sudan by then. We did have by then 42 organizations, 42 diaspora South Sudanese organizations in Holland. And knowing the Sudan, just going back, knowing the Sudan as a complex country, and some of you know Darfur, at least. But then you have to acknowledge also that South Sudan by then, you have the North Sudan, you have the East Sudan. So the political complexity and the cultural diversity and the complexity of the Sudan made it very difficult, actually, for Sudanese communities to come together and say, hey, we are going to sit together. Because you still have the ethnic issues. You still have the religious issues. You have South Sudanese, most of them are Christians. North Sudanese, most of them are Muslim. And their organization are only based on religious beliefs or background. So it made it very difficult for us actually to come together. So the first step that we took, what we undertook, is actually to dialogue. First, let's just sit. Just sit, dialogue, and start talking. And let's see whether we have some commonalities. And we took an advice of one of our scholars. He said, it's a very simple phrase. He said, does Sudanese, what divides Sudanese actually is what is unsaid, or what is not said actually. Because when I assume that he hates me, even though he doesn't hate me, but it's just that is my assumption, and then putting it in my mind, and I'll build a mountain out of it. It's like, okay, he looks at me, so he doesn't like me, because I'm from this or from that. So these things that were not said became an issue, actually, into it even led afterwards into the Sudanese civil wars that actually took place after the independence of Sudan. So we used that, and we said, okay, let's just dialogue. Let's just sit and see what will come out of it. The process itself to set up this platform, it took 3 years. Just to, in the end, to have an end product that is called the Sudan Civil Society Forum. And that was one of the first, let's say, country platform, or a platform that was based on a country that coming from Africa or from Latin America. And it wasn't without difficulties, but the fact that we started dialoguing, people started understanding each other, and all of a sudden we found out, hey, we have a lot of commonalities. We have themes that we can work on. We don't have to work on the issues of the ethnicity, I come from this area, we come from that area, but there are themes that we do have in common. So that's how that knowledge of setting up the platform actually extended afterwards, and then other platforms in the Netherlands actually started coming up, also being supported also by development agencies and also by the Dutch government. And then these became focal points within the country. So if you need an Ethiopian community, then you have an Ethiopian platform of organization that you can tap into. If you need a network, or if you need a person who is knowledgeable about Ethiopia, or if you need whatever it is, you just go in and tap into that community. So a few years later, the idea became also afterwards that, okay, so since we know each other now, the majority of these diaspora community leaders know each other, why don't we just come up with a formula that will transcend all these interests? And the formula became the Diaspora Forum for Development. And it's a transnational network, not only for African organizations that are based in the Netherlands, but actually also from Latin America. We do have members from Colombia, from Venezuela, from Ecuador, from Bolivia. And also in Asia, we do have members from the Afghani platform, Indonesia, from Bangladesh. And at the beginning, everybody was like, what the hell are you thinking about? But we took the same approach again in just sitting together and dialogue. And that actually became a very, it helped us in reaching this positive step in the end in setting up this platform. And then the same strategy was also, we should not look at the origin where we come from. Let's learn from each other, exchange experiences, exchange the best practices that we have. If the Ethiopian did a project that is actually working in Ethiopia, you can actually, you don't need to redefine the wheel or go and reinvent it again, but then try to actually learn from it and then modify it according to the local condition that you have in the country of origin. So that became one of the main pillars of the organization, exchanging ideas, and also becoming actually a platform for lobby and advocacy. And that's why we can come later on also to the idea that, okay, we can extend this idea of lobby and advocacy within the government or within the local government also in Holland or within the development agencies for that matter. And the important thing is also at international level, and that's where we met a few times with Kathleen, and we met in Mexico, I think, also with Devlin in Puerto Vallarta. And we took that strategy in, if you want to change policies, you have to do it also from actually from the grassroots level. But then you can go up there, because in the end, you have to utilize the human resources, the knowledge, the expertise that you have within the diaspora communities. Because so many heads can think together, than one head, actually. So that became actually our motto, in which you have a Latino that will think with an African. We do have very different thinking. And then all of a sudden, the Latino will think differently, very emotional. And like, okay, this is what we want to realize. It's beautiful. At the beginning, the communication aspect was an issue. And also the cultural understanding, because you might say something that is offensive to someone, but you don't mean it, actually. But this is how you were brought up as an African or as a South Sudanese. And then later on, you'll understand the Filipinos actually do not like it. So then you have to adapt yourself to this new environment that you're in. And then it's like, okay, and then the Filipinos be saying these things very nicely, and all of a sudden, hey, why is it saying, is he insulting me or something? So you tend to get to know each other, actually, as a human being, and also and different cultures that actually exist within our community. So the diversity became one of our strengths point, actually, within migration or within the Diaspora Forum for Development. The next approach that came out of that, and that's always uniqueness of this platform, is that we thought, okay, let's just transcend ourselves again and then think in a very different way, and that is the idea of setting up a European-wide diaspora platform in which you can have such a platform, but then at the European level, so that these voices that are actually taking place, and they will say, okay, these guys are very divert or very, very divisive, very divided, and you can't reach them, you can't talk to them. Let's just go out there and try to research and see which organization or which like-minded organization are willing to set up such a thing. So we started with an expert meeting in the Netherlands itself, two expert meetings. We invited several members of the diaspora communities in different countries, from Nordic countries, also from the South European countries, from Italy, from the UK, let's say Ireland also included in that, and then from France, Belgium, and Switzerland. And what appeared by then, and what we actually were very, very astonished about, is the fact that they shared the same vision, that there is a need for such a community, a diaspora community at the European level, that can sit together and exchange also expertise and ideas and knowledge. And also, if you have a Filipino diaspora group who's sitting in Italy, and you have a big Filipino group in Holland, and then they are communicating with each other, all of a sudden, it makes it also easier for these communities. So if you're going to Italy, you don't have to worry, actually. You just go there, make a phone call, and say, hey, someone will just, you know, receive you up, and even at a personal level, meaning that anyway, so that you can use that, actually, and utilize that at a personal level, and at a professional level, that's the beauty of it. So this idea is going on now. We are almost there. The Dutch government is actually supporting the idea. They've gave us a bit of a funding. We do have an international working group with people coming from Norway and Sweden being part of the board of this international working group, and also in other countries. So this is an initiative that's still going on, and we hope that the end product will be as beautiful as this. This is also going to be part of the documentation. We do have some wonderful reports that we are trying also to document later, and see the diaspora engagement in that process. Finally, before I go to that one, to the document, the circular migration that you're talking about, and I think it's a very important element actually to mention, that it is very important for diaspora nowadays also to think back home and then try to go back, but not fearing that the fact that, okay, if I go back, I'll not have the same opportunities, or I'll lose my job and all of this. So one of the examples that we liked a lot and we participated in, some of the diaspora groups in Holland participated, is in a program that was funded by the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, but then for IOM to implement, and that is what they call the TRQN, the Temporary Return of Qualified National. And they had five countries, and which by then Sudan was part of it. And I say that the Sudanese community used that very effectively. You'll have someone who's a nurse, who's a doctor, who's an engineer, that wants to go back temporarily, you know, just go and share the expertise and the knowledge with the people, you know, but then making sure that the job that you have, you're not going to lose. Because if you leave for 6 months, that's a problem, because your employer will say, hey, I can't afford you leaving actually for 6 months, because in the end, I need to hire someone actually in your place. But somehow it worked. Most of the companies actually liked the ideas that the diaspora were going back to contribute to their countries, and you go for unpaid leave. You're not getting anything, but you get some funding from the IOM. And that is one of the circular migration initiatives that actually the migrants or the diaspora communities from these five countries actually liked. And the idea now, what you're doing also with the IOM is to, it's very unfortunate that that this project is coming to an end, but it's getting evaluated now by the ministry, and they're trying to see whether they can extend it or not. So we are actually helping IOM in also brainstorming with them and try to come up with some innovative ideas or develop something out of this so that it will become also a sustainable project for the future and that diaspora communities can use it. So it's beautiful.
it's so encouraging to hear how many projects are actually going on now.
Yeah. And all of that, you're doing it voluntary, and we do not have actually full staff that work for the organization. I have my professional job,
mm-hmm.
I have to take a day off actually today to come to Brussels. Imagine that. I work in a hospital, specialized in nuclear medicine and radiology, and also it applies also to other board members and to other diaspora groups that are working in the financial sector or whatever. But then you just do contribute with whatever type of time that you have. But at the same time, it's a challenging
fantastic
issues, a challenging moment actually for all of us. But still, it's just the fact that it's part of you. Part of you as
and it's the energy of diasporas, and it's in that that you really see this tremendous potential. So thank you so much. I know there are so many people here today who are really deeply involved in this issue. We have people from DEVCO, from ICMPD, from UNHCR. I also want to introduce my colleague. Santo mentioned that MPI Europe has now existed, and I think probably most of you have had a chance to meet Liz Collett. Can you just wave your hand? If any of you haven't, please introduce yourself to the director of MPI Europe and Milica, her colleague. They are here, they're involved, and they're our lifeline in Brussels. So we're really grateful to them for together with the IOM office here, for organizing this meeting. So all of you who are working deeply involved in this issue, please jump in if you would like to. Yes, please.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Hello, good morning. My name is Alexandra Lenné. I'm actually part of the Belgian National Contact Point for the European Migration Network, which yesterday and the day before organized a conference in Norway on the topic of migration and development, so which really puts emphasis on this topic for the moment and is really willing to actually engage more into gathering evidence and trying to actually mine, extract information. So the piece of information that you present today is very much of importance to us and very timely. Thank you for that. Also, I would like to, I would have a question to Mr. Deng, who just made a presentation, which was actually tremendous, just great, just as you said, Mrs. Newland, expressing lots of potential and energy. And actually, one of the issues that we discussed at the conference in Oslo was the expectation issue towards the diaspora. And I would be very much interested to hear from you whether this issue of the amount of expectations which more and more lies on the diaspora, how it is being dealt with, although you mentioned that most of you are voluntarily working for the board, so I guess the willingness is there, but how is the expectations, how are expectations being dealt with? And another question would be, as you were talking about the end product, is there a website or are there information products on the initiatives of the board available somewhere? Could you give more information on that? Thank you.
Thanks. I'd like, if you wouldn't mind, Santo, to sort of hold that thought, and while we get a few other comments, please.
Thank you. Thorsten Moritz of the Church's Commission for Migrants in Europe. Two questions. The first one, I wanted to pick the brains of Dublin and Eva on positive interactions between traditional development actors and diaspora actors. And that goes a bit back to our experience. As I say, I work for a church organization. there's lots of church development organizations, and we've been trying to organize or to mobilize a buy-in of these actors into the issue of migration development. And now this is a bit of a caricature how I'm doing it, but the first reaction is, diaspora, that's peanuts. Then you come in with the remittances and they say, oh, that's a lot of money, actually. It's more than ODA. Second point, oh, these guys are going to take our jobs. Third point, let's give them a bit of money for a pilot and hope they will shut up. As I said, it's a bit of a caricature, but I'm still wondering on good examples of, it is clear that what a diaspora can do and what an official development association can do in cooperation is slightly different. And in an ideal world, you would say, okay, maybe a general sanitation network in country X is something we can do with ODA. And on the basis of that, diaspora can do this and this in an ideal world. But I'm seeing very little of it. And I was wondering whether you had examples of positive interactions there. Because there's lots of territorial differences there trying to defend your turf. To Rodrigo, I had two questions. With the global approach, it's a marvelous document. I wouldn't like to work on the basis of it as the Commission, because when it gets to hard facts, you will often have to say, yeah, but quotas, that's member states. I'm really, really sorry about it. Is there any forum where you're discussing with the member states, okay, what do we need to attain in terms of volume? Because another heretical remark, if I look at the experience of Moldova, my impression is more people in Moldova experience the EU through re-entry bans than through a mobility partnership. Mm-hmm. This is not academically funded in any way, but this is a perception. If you talk to people, the perception is more, oh, nasty EU regulations on migration, and less of, oh, there's a mobility partnership. So don't we need to talk volume at a certain point in time in order to make it work? And second point, very important thing, of course, the EU can do, the Commission can do, is fund. But how in the future perspectives can you see to create space for initiatives which may not yet be a fully developed organization? The experience Santo has been sharing, of course, is an experience lots of other organizations, particularly diaspora organizations, have no or very little permanent staff, which makes it very, very difficult to manage a budget of 500,000. But what we keep hearing from your colleagues in finance and DGO, but also in development, is, oh, we'd rather have five projects for 1,000,000 than having 50 projects for 100,000. So do you see any space there to create space for something which can be a bit more experimental, a bit more supporting fragile structures in the startup?
Great, thank you. What I'd like to do, if Frank agrees, is get these comments and questions on the table, and then we'll come back to the panelists so you can respond to it, and then Frank can wrap up. So please, Sarah. Thanks.
Hello, my name is Sarah Schlager, and I work for the International Center for Migration Policy Development here in Brussels. And we are working currently with four migrant-led organizations to build an African diaspora platform for the development of Africa. And we're working with one partner in the Netherlands, one umbrella organization here in Belgium, another umbrella organization in France, and one in the UK. And this project is financed by the European Commission and co-financed by the GIZ, also the Dutch government, and and the Swiss, also showing the interest that currently exists and that you've all been mentioning, to support diaspora engagement. We are currently, it's a three-year project, and we've worked for 18 months now and have basically established the basic tools, such as a website, to be further working on this project. And we had a first expert meeting in which we did something similar than the DFD has done, just only with African diaspora organizations. We've invited one expert from each EU member state, including Switzerland and Norway, and who would represent in some way one of the platforms that exist in each country, to exchange and to work on building this sustainable platform for the development of Africa. And what we've seen, we're very pleased about it, is there has been so much interest in this from the expert, and they have really supported us now in the development of, you know, organizational charts and really the development of building the sustainable platform, which would actually lead to our main objective, which is passing on this project to these experts and then basically helping them to, you know, continue working on this project, to exchange best practices, to actually give to the other partners the opportunity to ask, okay, what do you want? How do you want us to engage with you? What are your aims? What are your goals? What are your objectives? And we're going to have another expert meeting coming up in the end of this year in Paris, in which we're going to further work on establishing the platform, exchanging best practices, and also working with the pilot countries. We have 5 African pilot countries to establish better this link between the diaspora and their home governments, because this is really a link, as we've had a discussion yesterday, saying, okay, but how do you engage with the diaspora? What's the one good thing to do? And it's really, it's a question of tailor-made, I mean, how the governments can engage. And we've chosen 5 very different countries to really also get the different experiences done, and we're looking forward to having this discussion at the end of the year. And we'll, of course, then also report on our website if you would like to consult it. It's ae-platform.org. And also for all the diaspora members, if they would like to register, we'd be very happy. Thank you.
Could you tell us what the 5 pilot countries are, Sarah?
Just of so course. It's Senegal, Cameroon, Angola, Ethiopia, and Morocco.
Thanks. Great.
Oops, sorry. Sara Monterisi from DGDEFCO, the European Commission. One question to the authors of the handbook, and also maybe I will try to contribute to a reply on the funding. The question is, having a look to your roadmap at page 24, I find that one of the probably of the most difficult steps is building trust.
Oh, yes.
Let's say there are diasporas who really just don't trust the government of their countries of origin and the institutions for many different reasons, for historical reasons, traditions are different, etc. So I was wondering if there are experiences that you could, let's say, flag of positive experiences in building trust with the diasporas.
Sure.
The contribution to the reply is very true. Diaspora organizations have real difficulties in applying to our budget lines, including the migration and asylum budget line, for many reasons. One is definitely weak management capacities, fragile institutional frameworks, as you were mentioning. Our advice, would be to start with another budget line, for example, with the non-state actors budget line, that has a different purpose, because the purpose is really to reinforce the capacities of these organizations that really need to be reinforced before maybe asking them to manage development projects and things like that, and also have thresholds in terms of co-funding that are more easily accessible to these organizations. Thanks.
Thank you.
Actually, this ties in very well with just what Sarah said. My name is Aspasia Papadopoulou from the European Council on Refugees. And what I'd like to flag is actually that we are, as an organization, together with a few partners, one of them being DFD, are just going to start a project that is advocacy and capacity building on the role of actors such as civil society and diaspora in implementing projects in countries or in third countries. And that is actually funded through the non-state actors fund budget line that was just mentioned by DEVCO. So yes, there are ways to engage, and that a first step might be to team up with civil society organizations, being European ones, or civil society organizations that are international or based in the country of origin to get started, and then potentially when there is the capacity, then diaspora organizations as such can apply as leaders in a project. By the way, I think it might be interesting for the audience, since everybody is more or less focused specifically on diasporas here, to mention that the particular project is going to look at refugee diasporas. And I know we're looking at diasporas here in general, but I think it might be interesting to flag that there are certain issues that refugees, diasporas in particular, face. And when we talk about trust, well, this is a particular case where it's clearly not possible to have trust when you're fleeing conflict and violence. And there are all sorts of questions coming up. So how do you actually engage with your country of origin? How do you support? How can you do that? You want to, but you can't.
I'm really glad you brought that up, because refugees are often overlooked as agents of change in their home countries, and it's a very important one. We just had a roundtable at MPI with the Iranian diaspora in the United States. It was looking at exactly that sort of question: how can you be an active and engaged diaspora when you can't talk to the government of your country of origin? Doesn't mean you can't act in your country of origin necessarily. Anyway, sorry. Yes, Mr. Hemingway.
Thank you very much. My name is Bernd Hemingway. I'm from IOM, and further, I should not congratulate, but I have to congratulate you. It's really great work, and given our involvement, I shouldn't do that. And I also should probably know the answers to my questions working for IOM, but I have to admit that there are better experts than me on that one, so I kind of out myself by asking those questions. I would like to come back to the handbook, and obviously the projects already now described by colleagues here in the room show the necessity to have such a handbook and the added value of it, and I think all the people implementing those projects will most likely use the handbook. But my question is also, I mean, given that the history started with the Global Forum, what is the monitoring of the implementation of the handbook now? How do we make sure it is really used? And that question goes in a way to the authors or owners, but also to Eva, because we are coming up with a vision of what the Global Forum should be in the future. And I think the handbook is one of the tools where the Global Forum could play a role in the implementation. And alongside with that, are there any plans for training? Because I'm just kind of looking into my own organization, where we just had a handbook on project development. And we had a huge training exercise for all the project development offices around the world. And now we have a handbook here. And do we expect everybody else to learn it or autodidactic? Or do we kind of have some plans for training? I think that would be good. And then my last question is, we also have, but what I can see nowadays is there's a lot of involvement of diaspora also in democratization. And I know that this is a very, very touchy issue. And that also comes back to the trust issue, comes back to refugees, comes back to political agendas. But that is something that is not at all touched in the handbook. And was this a conscious decision, or is that something that is too kind of sensitive to have it discussed at all? Thanks.
No trick questions here. Yes.
Hello?
Yes.
Okay. So, thank you. My name is Sabine Böltgen. I'm the coordinator of the MILA Great Lakes program that I'm happy to see quoted as well in the handbook. So, what I wanted to say just before coming to my question, because it's difficult to stick to the question, because it was so many interesting input had come now from the other speakers. And I think one general remark that I would like to make, and that I would like to just recommend before coming to my concrete question, is to say, when we are speaking about networks of diaspora, it might be interesting as well to have a network between us. I mean, what I realize is that there are really a lot of projects being done and a lot of different experience being done among the different institutions, the different organizations, even within here in Brussels. And I think it would be very good to better know each other and to know what everyone is doing in order to create synergies. This is one thing that I wanted to recommend, maybe as a result as well as such meetings like today. My concrete question would be concerning the this goes very well with the remark of Mr. Hemingway in the sense of implementing trainings, because from my experience, I have to say that we are now considering the possibility how to go further in our approach and our implementation of our MIDA program, in the sense to go further in the appropriation of the MIDA, let's say, of including in a systematic manner development into diaspora into the development of the home countries, but in the on the side of the government itself. I mean, we are working with the governments of DRC, Rwanda and Burundi, and a phenomenon that I'm seeing now in the current 2 and 3 years is that they have several departments and departments and services, I have to say, really popping up that are in charge of diaspora. And not, I mean, to have a service in charge of diaspora does not mean yet that you know what to do in this regard. And now they are coming to us and asking us very oftenly, well, I have this mandate now, but what shall I do? I have no budget, I have no terms of references. I realize that 5 other colleagues and 5 other ministries are in charge of this as well. And so we find situations there where we have very complicated and a very delicate situation where it is very difficult to bring everybody around the table. And this is what we would like to do now in the future of MIDA Great Lakes in our 3 partner countries, to go further in the sense to say, let's really elaborate together a strategy how to build up this roadmap. So in this sense, thank you very much. It's coming in the ideal time. And my question is now, when will we have the French version? Because this will be very important for us. And as well, my question, or maybe a recommendation, is because when we see this kind of handbooks, I'm sure that we will all find the time to read it, if it's in total or in chapter. But to be honest, when I organize a meeting or when I organize a working session with the governments, I mean, with the government representative in the partner countries, I don't think that they will be able to read it. I mean, they will not do it because they don't have the time. I mean, they will not go so much into details. They will expect from us to guide them with the training tool or with a module or whatever. So would it be possible, when I think, for example, of this great roadmap that you have on page 24, do you have as well some some pedagogical tools or modules that we could use in working when we organize workshops with the governments when we want to elaborate such a strategy? This would be extremely helpful. So this is just a thing. And just
I think I'll take that as a suggestion rather than a question.
That's a very good one. Okay. And just a very, very last question to Mr. Deng, because I think I just had the question, do you have as well the Great Lakes region, I mean a Great Lakes region subgroup in your forum? Then it would be, then I would be very happy to speak with you afterwards.
Okay.
Thank you.
Great. I'd like to turn back to the panel now, but if I can abuse my position just a little bit, I just want to tell you an anecdote in response to that last question about the origin of the roadmap. I think it was in sort of late December 2008 that I was sitting with members of the diaspora from an African country in Washington, and they were starting to work with their embassy in Washington to develop a diaspora sort of strategy for Ethiopia. The Washington embassy had been tasked with that by the foreign ministry. So we sat with members of the diaspora, with people from the embassy, and started talking about, you know, sort of how to engage the diaspora and so on and so forth. And at some point, you know, and I referred them to several pieces of research that we'd done, and they said, you know, our officials don't have time to read. They just don't have time to read. Even if you give us a 10-page paper, it's not, can you draw us a picture? And I said, took a napkin and said, yes, I can draw you a picture. And that literally is how this roadmap started to try to, but, you know, as it became elaborated, it's even it has become a little bit hard to read. So I very much appreciate your idea that we need to develop additional sort of tools to convey some of these ideas and not necessarily in sort of lots of words. So thank you for that. So lots of issues have been put on the table. I think maybe we'll sort of go in reverse order, if that's all right. I'm unfortunately going to have to ask you to be selective and to be really brief, and hopefully we can continue these conversations after. I hope this will be the beginning of a lot of conversations rather than the end of one. So, Santo, just 2-3 minutes. I'll start waving frantically when...
I'll keep it short anyway.
Thanks.
Thank you, Alexandra, for the question. It was actually about the expectations toward diaspora and how they deal with it, actually, or how they were dealt, or how they dealt with the these expectations. If I understood your question correctly, then it's much, well, in our terms, we do have two things of understanding towards this issue. You have the expectations from the diaspora to this platform for whatever they're doing, and then you have the expectations from the policymakers towards the networks of these diaspora organizations. So these are two sets of also expectations that you have to manage. And to manage the expectations within your own network, then, as also has been mentioned here, then you have to use these tools, actually. And one of them is trust. Because later on, or early on when I was talking, I was saying that dialogue improves the trust between people. Because you start dialoguing because you want to reach a common consensus or you understanding, whatever you can name it. That is how you start, because in the end, you will get to know each other very well. What are your expectations from each and every one of you? And also the intentions. That's where you know whether there are genuine intentions or actually not genuine intentions. And that's how you can actually manage the expectations afterwards, because some of them might get really disappointed afterwards. They'll say, oh, but this is not the idea in which we set up the platform, because they were actually hoping for a different outcome. Some of them have very different expectations that, okay, I'm coming to this platform because there is money, for example. While there is no money, then a year later or 2 years later, I don't see any money, for example. Some of them are just coming for the exchange of experiences and the best practices and also finding the network and also facilitating whatever actually comes in within the network. And they're totally satisfied with that. So in the end, if you manage to dem all these expectations so that all of us have the same outlook toward things, then I think you can manage that. Towards the government, it's still sometimes a bit, they still look at migrants or migrant organizations or platforms. And I'm just taking the example of the Dutch government that you see there is the expectations are now coming much higher, because in the past they used to like say, hey, let's say 10 years ago, you can't even sit with a policymaker on the table just to discuss issues of diaspora. It wasn't heard of at all. But let's say within this period of 10 years, a lot have changed. So there is also certain expectations from the policymakers towards the diaspora networks and groups and the diaspora communities. And also there is an expectation also from the diaspora group towards the government. And also these expectations is also in terms of dialogue, in terms of trust, in terms of engagement, that you should not be talking about us anymore, but we should talk together, actually. Just sit on the table, discuss issues, and brainstorm together, issues relating to migration and development and issues relating to diaspora groups. The last part is the new initiatives. I think we have our website. I can give you my card later on. And two initiatives, and then I will just shut up. Two initiatives that we are actually involved with at the local level, with the local government, that is the city, the municipality of The Hague. They have, with the local parties within the city council, we did actually lobbied for The Hague to be the shelter city, what they call the shelter city initiative, for The Hague to provide, because The Hague is actually promoting itself as the city of justice and peace and all of this. Because, you know, the ICC is there, the International Former Tribunal Court for Yugoslavia and also for Sierra Leone. So there is this initiative that was initiated also within the municipality that they want to set up actually a shelter initiative in The Hague for human rights activists. So this is one of the initiatives, one of the new ones. And the last one is actually the setting up of the Global Justice Institute also in The Hague. So it's also, if you need much more information, you can just come later on. Thank you.
Okay, yes, sorry to have to cut you off, but Rodrigo.
Thank you very much, Kathleen. Yes, very quickly as well. So on the funds, first, thank you so much, Sarah, for giving me these details. And I just want to add a couple of things. On the fund, this is a recurrent problem. I mean, we already spoke about it last year. I remember, Santofi, of course, it would, in an ideal world, it would be so easy to knock on the door of the European Commission and to be able maybe to obtain without so much paperwork and this little project and stuff. Are we really the right actor there? I mean, my question is, how many European funds have been used through municipalities, through regions, through local authorities, and have actually benefited, for example, diaspora organizations? And so this is also, it's a centralized world in Brussels, huh? And of course, we are somehow obliged, I mean, just by the fact that also the European Union is one of the biggest actors, one of the bigger donors for development aid as such. I mean, the philosophy behind is also like to decentralize it as well. I mean, how many people would you need in DigiDevCo, I guess, to deal with all these micro projects? Mm-hmm. I don't know. And so it's also important to know how these funds are actually managed, and that's, and very often through regional and through local authorities. So these are still European funds, but of course also with the help of the local authorities for the co-funding, for example, this is, I guess, how they can be better used. But yes, I can understand this frustration. Is it going to change in the short run? I don't have a crystal ball. I'm skeptical, to be honest. Huh? I'm skeptical because...
Is it going to get a lot worse?
No. That I don't need a crystal ball to tell you no. Then on your second question on the volumes. You know, first let me give you a very technocratic answer, but it's written black and white in the Lisbon Treaty, you know, that the volumes, you know, and the quotas is exclusive competence of the member states. So, you know, maybe it's going to change in the next 200 years. I don't know. But we have to stick to the rules. And this is also important in order to have also a fruitful dialogue with the member states, also to stick to the rules. Do we discuss these things? Yes, we definitely do discuss these things in the high-level working group, for example, yesterday, I would say, you know. So we have different working groups in the council on which, you know, migration as such is discussed. And then to give you a concrete example on mobility partnerships, I told you this is like a political framework in the field of which, you know, in the frame of which different bilateral initiatives, sometimes very, very ambitious, can be undertaken between a third country and a specific EU member state. On volumes, for example, on quotas, you know, in our mobility partnerships, yes, we do have initiative which says like Italy is going to, I don't know, invite 3,000 Moldovan workers, for example. Yeah? So this is speaking about volume. So of course, it's not our legal competence, but we do speak about it, and we very often find also agreements on that. So this is part of the answer. And then on your perception of the Moldovan mobility partnership, I must say, I mean, let me be as straightforward as you were. I don't share it at all, your point of view. Yeah? I mean, when you look at the scoreboard, at the 80 initiatives that have already been undertaken since the creation of this mobility partnership, and the ones which are ongoing, I mean, it's very balanced, huh? And it's really not. It's definitely about opening the doors in a channeled way, mm-hmm. to Moldovan citizens, huh? And this is very much the perception we get from the Moldovan NGOs we're working with, and also, of course, of the Moldovan authorities, which are, by the way, super hyperactive with this mm-hmm. mobility partnership. That means something, I guess. So, I mean, when I look at the scoreboard, which is, I wouldn't say an academic document, but maybe gives a more objective hint of the situation, I must say it is much, much, much more balanced than that. And it's really not about closing the borders, but rather very much opening them.
Thank you, Rodrigo. But Eva, want to comment?
Thank you very much. There were actually so many excellent questions and statements from the floor, so I just have to speak very quickly. First, I'd like to actually turn to Santo and say that I enjoyed very much your description of how you started to work together in the Netherlands, because the same kind of process is actually what is happening in the Global Forum. You know, every word you said about coming together, sitting down, building trust, managing expectations of those who participate is the same for the states that that try to work together in global forum on global level on migration and development. We have very different starting points. We have lots of myths and misperceptions about each other and so on. And we are trying to set a common agenda. We're trying to identify problems that we have in common to really advance. And this is exactly the same thing. So I think we can talk about building a good process together. I really recognize that. And that work is not done, and it's not going to be done in the few coming years either. On the question from the Church's Commission on the interaction between different actors, I think that's a really relevant issue, a really important issue to discuss. Diasporas, groups, governments, and other development actors, other civil society actors that try to work towards the same goal. And I think that we are all, on the national level, on the global level, now having this discussion, who is a development actor? Mm-hmm. I think that is a really relevant, important discussion that is ongoing now, that we see new development actors like diaspora organizations, like the private sector, that is a little bit rocking the boat from the formula that we have had before. But I believe that only good things can actually come out of that. And for instance, just to cite the Swedish example, on the facility that we are creating for the Somali diaspora in Sweden, it is being implemented and hosted by a platform of organizations of Swedish civil society cooperation called Forum Syd. So they will be the sort of intermediate to help the implementation of this. Volumes, well, the Commission representative already spoke about that. I think that the discussion on mobility in the European Union is difficult, but it's an honest discussion, and it's really honest understanding between member states also that this discussion needs to take place. It's a difficult period to discuss it, and we approach it in different ways, as was pointed out, have the national competence to do it. Sweden, for example, is not interested in setting quotas, but we have changed our legislation instead, thinking that managing the demand and supply of labor, you cannot do by quota. That is old Soviet style kind of work, and that will not work. But I mean, so we have this discussion ongoing, and Sweden being a stark proponent for mobility, we always support the Commission on this issue. There are lots of things that can be done on the European level still. My colleague from the Commission said remittances, yes. The funding of a diaspora project via this kind of mechanisms, maybe of setting up some sort of facility also on European level for smaller projects managed by a greater, somebody that takes a bit better grip on it could be a possibility. I think that can be continued to work out. But I mean, just a parenthesis, is actually extraordinary that we have not done more on remittances on the European level. That is a task that I would send to the European Commission to continue to work very vigorously on for the future. Lot of development potential there, I think. Lastly, just to say to Bernd Hemingway, monitoring of the implementation of the handbook, what can we do for the future working with the Global Forum? The answer to that is really the sky is the limit. I mean, I think that we can really do a lot of follow-up using this also for setting agendas, but also following up, making also maybe more targeted surveys on how things are happening now, what the countries are doing. I think already at this next coming forum meeting in Mauritius, there is a round table that is discussing the diaspora. I'm sure that we can bring this book and experiences from that also to that, but definitely for setting the agenda for the Swedish Global Forum, yes, we are very interested in having this on our agenda. But also I would say for all of us to bring these thoughts to the high level dialogue in September 2000 in the UN General Assembly. I think that is also a task that we should set ourselves.
Very good, thank you. We are tragically out of time on this, and I'm so sorry, because there are so many more interesting questions that that we would love to discuss, and we're happy to continue afterwards. To Sarah's question on trust, asking about examples, I'd point to Mexico and India. Not that they've achieved trust, but they've gone about very systematically trying to build it, and I'd love to talk to you more about that. But in the interest of time, I'm going to go straight to Frank for a last word here. And as I say, I hope this will be the beginning of a conversation rather than the end.
Thank you very much, Kathleen. Maybe three quick responses to the points that were raised. One is on monitoring and of the implementation of the handbook. We plan to work with the GFMD's own support unit that helped to facilitate the collection of information through the first survey. And I think so the GFMD already has structures in place and maybe has not made sufficient use of those structures to date. And I think there is potential there. So through the GFMD focal points, I think we can help to update some of the information, but also ask the member states of the GFMD to what extent they're actually using the handbook, what has been their experience. And that really will not cost us a great deal and can be done fairly efficiently. Secondly, on training, there is an example of what can be done. The ILO, OSCE, and IOM first prepared a labour migration handbook, and then subsequently together created a labour migration training tool, which is now being used in training workshops in different parts of the world. So I think that's an interesting example. Thirdly, the French language version of the handbook will be prepared as soon as we get the money from Switzerland, which is on its way. And I think that's all, except that perhaps I can just say that I was delighted to hear about Gotland, because once upon a time, I was a Swedish Institute scholarship holder for 1 year, and the first thing that I was asked to do when I got to Sweden with the other scholarship holders was to go on a trip on a boat to Gotland. I'd never knew such a place existed, and so I'm very pleased to be reminded of that. So thank you very much, Eva, and thanks to all of you for coming today.
For information about MPI Europe, please visit www.mpireurope.org.